Good afternoon. We are going to begin the Minnesota House Ag Policy Committee. We are not quite yet at a quorum, but we do have a bill that will be coming before us. So on the agenda, the roll will be noted by the clerk, and we will just note when we receive a quorum here for the number of people. But we do have a bill that is ready to be presented, and as I mentioned yesterday, this is a bill that we're going to learn about today, but we're actually going to lay it over, and next week we'll be voting on it. So we'll get some testimony about the bill and about how it works exactly, and then we'll have a little bit more time if needed on Wednesday to be able to discuss it next week. And just a reminder that next week on Wednesday it's the 8:15 time, so for everyone who's going to be coming to testify on the bill. All right, so I think we will just go ahead. Representative Hansen is here with this bill, and there may be I will just move that House File 151 be recommended to pass, and it's going to be referred to the Committee on, I think, Environment, Natural Resources, Ag, Finance Committee. So, and then I know that there was an adjustment. I'll just announce the adjustment a little bit. In who's going to be here. Dr. Durgan is not here, so we're going to change it around a little bit as you're looking at your agenda. We'll start with the Department of Agriculture. Joe Spitzmuller is here, and Greta Gauthier is going to be here. So they'll start out. We'll have Michael Schmidt from the University of Minnesota College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Science, and then we'll hear from Bill Bond. And if there's anyone else in the audience who wanted to present today, and we'll be stopping hopefully about 1:15. I think that we'll have an FFA member that will be here then to present for a while, and then we have Representative Cresha here to do his presentation. So, and we do now have a quorum, so I'm going to be able to announce that we have a quorum, and then we'll go ahead with Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House File 151 is dealing with pesticide applicator certification and licensing. And the pesticide applicator program is a long-time program that probably was last looked at in depth in the 1989 Groundwater Act. But it goes back even further into the 1970s with the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, and the creation of the EPA and setting up responsibilities in states. States, departments of agriculture, which serve as the lead regulatory agency, and state extension, state land grant colleges that work on training. This is a program that I worked personally at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture for many years. And many of the people in the audience that I worked on with this, and I've just recognized some of them I haven't seen for a while, but all of us have gray hair now. When we started, and some don't have any hair, right? But we've worked in the pesticide field for a while, and that's what happens at the legislature. So my intent in this bill is to try to, and there's a fiscal, most of the bill is dealing with a fiscal impact. It is raising a fee, 0.1%, on what the registrants, the chemical companies who register their products for sale, whether they are a farm product, a lawn care product, a structural pest control product, 0.1%, which is way most of the pesticide regulatory functions are funded at the Department of Ag, to pay for updating the manuals, both in terms of content and in terms of media. And so the bill itself, just walking through page one, it references the finances, which will be discussed in the Environment and Ag Finance Committee. And then section three is the statutory definitions of pesticide education and training. And so looking at this, which really hadn't been looked at, I think, here at the Capitol for probably two decades, just trying to update this, define it a little clearer, and to add some components that folks in the education and training program, not the regulatory program here, but the education and training, this is where we work with applicators, where they learn about these programs and they're tested on them. And that's when we move into the regulatory side, where they're issued a certification or license. So on section 318B.305, again, clarifying the lead agency and having on 4.10, developing but also implementing or approving and evaluating manuals. And I've added the MNSCU system or any other educational institution in along with the University of Minnesota so that we can maybe broaden the pool when we're dealing with the capacity of getting these manuals done. Putting some adjectives in the pesticide concerns that are identified, adding for the training dealing with pesticide drift, relevant laws including pesticide labels and labeling, and then current science and technology updates. Having educational planning meetings for the training where you include representatives of industry but also the applicators themselves to provide input on how the training can work. And kind of similar content consultation. And then the last sentence where it's not only a prevention of pesticide occurrences in groundwaters, but groundwater and surface water. Because this pesticide applicator certification, training, and licensing covers a wide range of types of pesticide application and a wide range of types of licenses and a number of responsible folks who are involved in working on the training and licensing and certification, I thought the best way to do this was to have the Department of Agriculture here to walk through, give some background on the pesticide program, the training and certification and licensing, and have the University of Minnesota here as well, and walk through some examples. How does a farmer become certified? How does a lawn care applicator become certified and licensed? And so you're going to hear some terminology, you're going to see some numbers, and I think you'll find it very interesting. So with that, I would ask Greta and Joe Spitzmuller to come forward. I think the slide presentation has been provided to you in your packets that Mr. Spitzmuller will be going through.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. So when you're ready, you can just state your name from the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Greta Gothier with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to explain a little bit about the department's commercial pesticide license and private certification programs. I have Joe Spitzmuller with me today who oversees these programs in our department, and I'm going to turn it over to him to walk you through our PowerPoint, and we'd be happy to answer questions too. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Spitzmuller?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. And Representative Hansen.
And
my
again,
name is Joe Spitzmuller. I'm a manager at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I manage the facilities licensing and incident response section of the department. I've worked at the department for 22 years, and about 13 of those years I've been involved in the licensing and certification area. Rick was my supervisor when I, Representative Hansen, pardon me, was my supervisor when I joined the licensing and certification unit, and I became supervisor of that unit in 2005 and was for about 8 years. So my purpose here today, Madam Chair and members, is to give you an overview of licensing and certification, and I'm going to focus on three areas: the private pesticide applicator certification, the commercial pesticide applicator license, and the structural pest control license. And you should have this PowerPoint in your package, and it's also up on the slides. The authority for the program is comes both from federal and state law. FIFRA sets pesticide distribution requirements. Those are primarily related to pesticide registration and the pesticide label. The Minnesota Pesticide Control Law, Chapter 18B, exceeds the FIFRA in many regards. It creates a state registration. It also allows the department to do compliance inspection enforcement of these statutes, and it enables us to administer our certification licensing program, which we're talking about today.
Madam Chair, just for a point of reference, FIFRA is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide Act.
Thank you. Mr. Spitzmuller, and continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Every person in the state is required to obtain a license to apply restricted use pesticides or to apply pesticides for hire. And the three classes of certifications that they might obtain, one would be a private pesticide applicator certification, a commercial pesticide applicator license, and for the purposes of this presentation, I've incorporated non-commercial as well. And there's also a structural pest control applicator license. And they must have an applicator card in their possession when they make the application. This is an example of a card that they would hold, and I'd be happy to pass that around if that. The next couple slides will give a sort of a basic overview of how a person gets licensed. When a person seeks a license, they will fill out an application form. They will pay appropriate fees. And then they're required to take an exam. With that exam, they can either pass the exam or fail the exam. But ultimately, to obtain the license, they have to pass. So once they pass that exam, a license or a certification is awarded. And then to renew that license in a future date, they have to undergo some recertification training to make sure that they maintain their competency or the qualifications to hold that license. We have 17, in 2012, there were over 17,000 private pesticide applicators certified in the state. We had 10,000 commercial pesticide applicators certified, and we had about 1,000 structural pesticide applicators certified. This next slide illustrates some of the differences between the three categories. The private applicators are for the most part, farmers. They are producers of an agricultural commodity. They pay $50 for a license. It's valid for 3 years. For that $50, they get a certification from the Department of Agriculture, like the one you saw. And they $40 goes to the University of Minnesota Extension for the training that supports that license. The commercial applicators are for hire. They perform contract work. Now, these might be applicators who work for an agricultural co-op. They might be agriculturists who work for a lawn care business. They might be applicators who are providing mosquito control. But those would be types of applications made by commercial applicators. These are four higher applications. The cost of that license is $50. They would get a card like the one that's going around, and that license would be valid for 1 year. The structural applicators are applicators who focus their work in, on, around, or under structures, basically homes. These would be applicators who would perform bed bug control work, who would come in and manage insect problems in a home or rodent problems in a home. That's the focus of the structural license. So the next series of slides will talk about manuals, categories, examinations, and recertifications. We'll focus a little bit more on those topics. A category defines a typical work performed in a pesticide use area. So a person performing right-of-way work would have a typical set of tasks that they would have to know. And that would be different than the tasks that a mosquito control applicator would have to know, or an agricultural applicator would have to know. So the category defines the typical work performed by that in that applicator application area. Study manuals are available to help persons study for the exam. And I have a series of study manuals. And the first one is a manual. This is the manual that a private pesticide applicator would be taking a test on. This is a manual, and I'm happy to pass these around if that's all right. So a private pesticide applicator would be tested on this exam, would need to pass the exam in order to get their certification. A commercial applicator or a structural applicator would first have to pass a core examination. That's a basic, these are, core would be basic applicator principles. So all applicators, whether they're commercial or structural, would need to pass the core. And those are the two exams together. So combined, an applicator would be tested on that core material. Then there would be individual category exams. So here I have an example of an aerial manual. So if there's an applicator who is applying pesticides by air, they would pass the core exam, they would pass the aerial exam, and for example, they might be applying to right-of-way. So they would also pass a right-of-way exam. So in that case, an aerial applicator would pass three separate exams. And I have different category exams. There's an antimicrobial category, a soil fumigation category, a stored grain and fumigation category, along with the aerial category. So those are manuals that I had readily accessible, and so feel free to browse those. So going to the third bullet in this page, a person must pass the category exam along with a core test to obtain a certification. It's a fairly substantial requirement for applicators. Recertification enables, and we'll talk a little bit more, but once they are licensed, they need to undergo ongoing training in order to renew that license. Remember, for the commercial and the structural, these licenses expire every year. For the private applicators, they expire every 3 years. The University of Minnesota Extension, Dr. Dean Hertzfeld, is responsible for writing manuals, and that's based on a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Agriculture. In the creation of exam, there are typically three ways in which we take on an exam. And all of these three ways are represented in the manuals are going around. And an exam can be written from scratch, can be started with a blank page. And that's the case of the private applicator manual that's going around. Essentially, it was written from scratch. A manual can be revised. We can look at a manual that another state is using, and we can revise it to suit the needs of the Minnesota applicators. And the stored grain and fumigation example that's going around is an example of that. That was written by the Extension Service in Nebraska. We collaborated with Nebraska, revised that manual, and now we've adopted it. A third way is that we just adopt a manual, essentially take it off the shelf. And there's a couple manuals that were written that way. The aerial manual was written based on joint funding from EPA and the National Association of Departments of Agriculture Research Foundation funded that manual. It was written at a national level, and many states have adopted that as manual as their standard. This is a trend that's happening in this area, and it's a way to manage the significant costs required to create manuals. The University of Minnesota Extension will sell these manuals to applicators who are preparing for the exam. And I think they will talk about this a little bit more, but they use that money that's taken, the revenue collected, as a way to fund their program. And so the final point I wanted to just talk about a little bit is that subject matter, the manuals are not developed in a vacuum. Subject matter experts are brought in within that use category to help us identify tasks with associated with that use. And actually, we have people who have acted as subject matter experts in this room. We always appreciate that.
Mr. Mueller, before you go on, we have a question.
Yes.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And going back to, it would be slides 6, 7, and 8. When you talked about the license and certification, the total number of individuals that received license.
Yes, sir.
And then on slide 8, you talked about the cost of that. And I was doing some rough math, and that was about $1.5 million. But I see that one license is every 3 years. So, of course, I'd have to do the math accordingly. So it'd be somewhere shy or right around $1 million a year. Those dollars that are raised then, does that cover the cost to administer? What do those dollars that are raised go for? That'd be one. And the second one, I believe I heard you right, you're saying the manuals, a lot of those dollars are received federally where that's already covered. And so my question is, and then you sell those manuals to gather additional dollars for this program. So if we are already getting the dollars necessary, why do we need an additional tax in order to raise more money, I guess? That's the point I'm trying to get to.
Mr. Spitzmuller.
Madam Chair, Representative, to the first question, the dollars, I'll focus on the $10 from the private fee and the $50 from the commercial license and the $50 from the structural license come to the Department of Agriculture. Those dollars support our licensing and certification program, as well as the other regulatory efforts associated with licensed applicants. Under the private, $40 of that $50 collected goes to the University of Minnesota Extension, and that goes to support the training efforts and testing efforts for private pesticide applicants. To question number two, Madam Chair and Representative, it is correct that these there are manuals that are being supported by other sources, by the some that I gave you examples of, the National Core, the National Aerial, and in terms of production, the Department of Agriculture has no expense in terms of production of those manuals.
Representative Hamilton?
Nothing.
Okay. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you for the presentation. I think everybody here agrees that if you're going to do a certification license, we want to have updated manuals and all that sort of thing. But with most of our application processes throughout all of our educational programs, usually the application fees and other things would be sufficient to support the manuals itself. Is there a reason why we would choose a taxing authority to pay for manual review rather than just increasing the license fee to cover it as well, which would seem more realistic to provide that?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Petersburg. The Department of Agriculture receives funding from a variety of sources, not only the pesticide applicator license fee, but also fees that are paid by the registrants. And those are the chemical companies who register their pesticides each year the state doesn't have to allow the use of that pesticide. They register it for the opportunity to sell that pesticide in the state. So registration fees are collected from the registrants, they're collected from the applicators, and they're collected fee for service with extension for both the both the training materials but also the recertification workshops that go on. And I think we'll, when we get into the applicators and the and where the dollars go in, when we get into the university and talk about some of that training, you're going to see fee for service, which has changed for the commercial or non-commercial and structural applicator programs, and the $40 certification fee that goes to the University of Minnesota. And I think if I can go back to Representative Hamilton's question, it might clarify it a little more. Out of the 17,000 applicators, they pay $10 to the Department of Ag. That's the statutory fee that really hasn't changed. When I was there, and there is a cost even for printing that card, handling, doing the data entry, I would doubt, and I'm trying to remember back when I would doubt that that $10 really covers or comes close to covering the actual issuing of that card and the personnel involved in it. The $40, which is flexible, it has, when I was working there, I think it was 25 and went up to 30 based on the need to recover the dollars. That's up to $40, so $50 total, 10 of which goes to run the program at the Department of Ag, $40 which goes to the University of Minnesota. The pesticide applicator fee that for commercial applicators, that goes into the Department of Agriculture to run their programs, whether it's the certification licensing program, it goes in the pesticide regulatory account. So I believe we have had a mixed blended dollars where applicators pay and the companies pay. They haven't changed in many years. What has changed, and you'll probably hear about an incident response surcharge has gone on back in 1989, I think it was $50 or $75 to help the fund, and the applicators paid that surcharge and the registrants paid that surcharge to help pay for cleanup of residual pesticide sites. There is a cost for developing the manuals. That's a cost that both the Department of Ag and the university have tried to reduce by adopting the other state manuals. The Department of Ag receives from the federal government a grant to run their programs in general that I think probably is $30,000-$40,000 a year that is specific. I'm trying to go off of memory here. But the cost you will see when the university comes forward of developing a manual from scratch or revising the manual, or when we developed the antimicrobial manual for with a grant from the federal government for us to state, you start to see some significant costs. I believe, and what I put in the bill, is that is a cost, a temporary cost, where the registrants can pay that fee rather than the applicators. My understanding, and this is a fiscal issue that will be dealt with, I think, in detail in the next committee, but what I put forward is that is, I have a five-year, one-tenth of 1%. Previously, we have dedicated one-tenth of 1% to the waste pesticide collection program, which Joe supervised before he got involved in the applicator program. So there have been things where we have looked at issues where dollars have been dedicated to certain things. This is an additional dollar that would blink off.
And Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, and if I, Chairman, if I could just have a follow-up question. You know, I understand the need for the development, and I understand the cost that it's there, but it seems like we put this in as a tax for 5 years in order to pay for that. In 5 years, those manuals, I'm assuming we're going to have new pesticides and new controls are going to create it over again, and it seems to me that if we're having commercial providers that need the licensure in order to provide the business they have, mm-hmm. then it does seem like it would be part of the registration or application fee for ongoing updating and so forth. And I'm just questioning why you would go tax versus an application fee for the dollars, because I know the importance of needing it. I just was curious.
Representative Hansen.
Well, Madam Chair, and the idea here, moving not only on the content, to update the content, but to move to different media so that when you bring, if we brought everything today, if we had a magic wand and say everything's going to be current as of today in every category across every type of license, things still change with new science, new technology. But if we move it from those paper manuals into an electronic format on the back end, so it's not just the hard copy paper, then the university and the agencies can update those at a lower cost. We move away from paper in terms of how they're designed, not necessarily how they're tested, but how they're designed. And that reduces the cost in the long run, because you can change the electronics rather than recalling a paper manual and say, and you can modify the test to put that new chapter in where maybe there's some new science in aquatic application. That's the idea. That's the part of the purpose here, is to change that media so that we can reduce the cost after we've brought ourselves up to the best standard in the country.
Is that good?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm still not quite clarifying my question. My question isn't about the need for the funding. My question isn't about the need for updating manuals or having that variance. My question is just simply is why is that cost of the manual repair put on to the retailer selling the product rather than the applicant who needs the license and the updated materials in an application fee instead? I'm just asking why you made the choice to go with a tax versus providing the same funding sources or flexibility of funding sources to the application fee, who, especially in a commercial, is part of their bread and butter.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, I want to be clear, it's not a tax on the retailer, it's a tax on the manufacturer.
Okay.
And it would estimate $400,000 a year. So it's 0.1% of gross sale. My philosophical thing to help the small businesses is, rather than putting the fee on the person, is to put it on the manufacturer, where they have, because, and we may differ on this, I believe they have a better ability to pay than the small business dealer, than the farmer, than the applicator, who may have to pay for that license out of their own pocket. I realize we may differ on that. I would rather have the fee, 0.1%, $400,000 on the manufacturers, pay that rather than the people who get the applicator license.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, you said that you didn't believe that the dollars that are collected cover the cost of the program. And I would like, the department to confirm that, whether or not those dollars received actually do or do not cover the cost of the program. The other thing that I'd like the department to comment on, we talked about keeping manuals current and the importance of, and I think everybody in this room believe that. You take a look at the manuals that are being passed around here. We have one, the 19th edition, and that was updated in 2011, I believe. We have this one, 2012. This one was 2010. This one, 2012. And this one was updated in 2013. Your expert opinion, are these up to date? Are our manuals behind the times? Are they outdated?
So, Representative Hansen.
And Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, before the agency responds, what you're seeing are the newest manuals out of 20 different categories. So you're seeing the best. You're seeing what the ability is for the agency and the extension service to do. And you're going to hear soon what the cost is to do the best. And we have 20 categories. I want to be clear on what I was saying. Talking about the private pesticide applicator program, a $10 certification, I doubt is covering the cost of administering that program. And I think you could hear from the department, because I remember when I supervised this, we cost-coded our time based on the programs that we operated on.
And from the department, Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hamilton, to your question regarding costs, covering, and so forth, we do not have that data with us today, but we will get it to you as soon as possible. One fact to mention is that the actual fee that the I'm just going to wait until we get the cost data here in front of us. And then for the second question, I believe, was are the manuals considered up to date? There are numerous manuals, and there are varying dates of where we are at in the process. We do have, overall as a department or as a unit of the department, there is an ongoing effort on that part. And I'll let Mr. Spitzmuller talk a little bit of detail about that, if that's what...
Mr. Spitzmuller?
Madam Chair and Representative, off the top of my head, I think we have 8 manuals that have been adopted that are adopted since 2010. We have about 7 manuals in service that were adopted since the year 2000. And we have another, I think, 6 manuals that were adopted before the year 2000. So that gives you, as was said, we have a range of manuals. The oldest manual that I am aware of is the manual for the category, the pocket gopher category. And that manual is at least 20 years old. I actually can't find a publication date on that manual.
Representative Hamilton.
So I guess for that one, for any of those, would they be considered then, would they be considered outdated?
Well, excuse me, Madam Chair and Representative, I guess an example that I could share with you is we have a turf and ornamental manual that was published in 1997. We are currently engaged in revising that manual. We took the manual to the industry, this 1997 manual, to the industry, and the industry said this was still a functional manual, even though it was published in 1997. So our plan then was to use that as an existing base, revise it, and it will come online probably in 2014. As far as the manuals that I shared today, these really are just manuals that I had available to me. So,
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple follow-up questions, and to echo Representative Hamilton, you have said, I believe it's my philosophy. Have you run the numbers? Is this speculation or is this fact that there's a delta between what's coming in and what's going out on the revenue and the expense side?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, I'm going off of my experience working in the Department of Agriculture, supervising this program, and continuing to check in with the department since I've been here. So I'm looking at if we had difficulty in covering the cost with a $10 certification that stays with the department back 8 years ago, I don't know if it's improved.
Ms. Gauthier. No? Okay. Then we'll go to Representative Kreisha.
So, and thank you, Madam Chair. Experience is a valuable thing, and my question is, do we know if there's a problem or not here?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha. There is a problem with the manuals. I think we're getting, again, mixed up between the certification licensing program, the $10. That $10 is within the department. We haven't had the testifier yet to talk about how much it costs to do a manual, what's involved, and how that's done. And we're going to get through the Department of Ag program at some point, and I think you will see what's involved, what the costs are with the manuals, which is what the bill purpose is.
Representative Kreisha.
But do we know if, thank you, Minister, do we know if there's a delta there? Is there a delta between what's coming in and what's going out, and how much is that? Those numbers have or haven't been run yet?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, you will see the data on how much it costs when they come through, because you have differences. You can take a longer period of time to get things done on the rotation that we're at. And then the longer time it takes to update the manuals, then the more likelihood is that there's changes in the science, there's changes in the application techniques, there's changes in the laws. So the longer it takes, if it's back to 1997, that it takes for the rotation of doing one a year or two a year or adopting another manual with the costs that are involved, that is, if you spread it out, you could do it, but you're not going to be up to date.
Wait.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I'm proud to say I'm a card-carrying private pesticide applicator. As I recall, there are 3 years, and the re-registration is due March 1st, and I'm down here, and I kind of panicked. I think 3 years ago, my card was expiring, mm-hmm. and Ms. Gauthier helped me access this, the test and the manual online. So it was online 4 years ago. So if we're talking about expenses of putting it online, at least the private one is already online. And I guess I'm a little bit confused. We're talking about the $10 fee to the department to update manuals, but the $40 fee to the university, do they in fact do the updating, or who does the actual groundwork of updating the manual?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, so I think there is some confusion here, because it gets confusing between certification and licensing, and it gets confusing between commercial applicators and private applicators. So private pesticide applicators, such as yourself, they take an open book exam. And that exam is based on the manual. Exams are written to the manual. So the manual has the minimum competency needed for that category, if it's a commercial or non-commercial applicator, or whether it's a private pesticide applicator. So when you get the manual, everything in that is the minimum competency that you would demonstrate your knowledge of by taking the exam. And with the private pesticide applicator program, that is an open book exam. With the commercial pesticide applicators, people who do it for hire, if I hire you to come and spray my lawn, or if I hire you to come and apply a pesticide on my field, or if I hire you to come and apply to a rope known to a lake, they have to meet the license fee every year, and they have to demonstrate minimum competency through a closed book exam. The closed book exam is based on the manual. So you have a hand-in-glove relationship between the Department of Ag and the university, where you develop the minimum competency that's in the manual. And this is the time-consuming, and this is a cost issue here, to identify the minimum competencies, to get them into a manual, and then to write the exams to that manual. Because the overall certification competency, the ability for the federal government and the state government to demonstrate that the applicators have knowledge in what they are doing, is measured through the exam. That allows them to go purchase a pesticide to apply for hire, or it allows the farmer to go purchase a restricted use pesticide and apply it on their own property without being for hire. There are costs involved in administering the program, whether it's printing the card, entering the data, getting that. There are costs involved with the program in writing the exams. The university will talk about the costs involved in writing the manuals, and they also operate the recertification programs. So right now, across the state, there are recertification for private applicators. You get the notice, you can go to a workshop. In addition, each category has varying recertification requirements, where you go to a training to learn more new things. Every year, you have that minimum bar where somebody enters into the license, and then when they stay to renew their license, they get that continual training. If you look, I'm going to jump ahead with Mr. Spitzmuller here, but when you look at where are the applicators, there's over 4,100 turf and ornamental applicators. When spring comes, you have, in a compressed period of time, companies hiring people, putting them through the training, through the manual, and then bringing them in to a closed book monitored exam to demonstrate their competency and to get them out in the logs. Turf and ornamental has become the largest of those categories. Most number of people, most number of new applicants.
Ms. Gauthier?
Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson, I thank you for your questions, and we will get to some of these issues, but just to summarize, in the interest of time, perhaps, you can take a look. But in addition to certifying for over 20 or so different types and numerous individuals at different times of the year, the department also puts on 80 workshops a year. In various areas around the state, we work in partnership with stakeholders. So, for example, if there's an annual meeting of a certain type of group, we might have a day early run a workshop to help that type of applicator become certified again. So we do try to, where we can, reduce our costs, but we do also feel very importantly that it's critical to make sure that the training is done, it's accessible to people, and like I say, we do 80 workshops a year.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Just a final follow-up, and thank you for the information. I think maybe where some of the confusion is coming here in realizing this is not a finance committee, but the feeling that this maybe would have been more comfortable coming as part of the governor's budget or your budget from the Department of Ag to cover this cost, I think that might be where some of the confusion is coming from.
Ms. Gauthier.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know about that, but I mean, I think that this whole area of regulation is confusing in and of itself because there's so many different types of applicators and so forth. But I will say that this is Representative Hansen's bill. It is not part of the governor's budget.
And I'm just going to note that we're running a little over, and I do have a student, a FFA student, who's traveled a distance to be able to do a presentation to us today. So I want to make sure that he's given his opportunity to do that. I do have two people who have a couple questions. So we're going to finish up with the questions for today, but then we will be laying this over until Wednesday, so we'll have that. But I do have Representative Falk, Representative Faust, and Representative Hamilton. So, Representative Falk.
Madam Chair, I can wait until their presentation and the rest of the press.
So we'll do that then on Wednesday. And Representative Faust?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, I think, will be relatively quick. When I look at the volume of the different areas where pesticides are applied, it seems to me that, you know, the largest percent is probably on corn, soybeans, spring wheat, beets, that type of thing. And the turf is relatively, I mean, pretty growing thing, as you mentioned. But it seems to me that most of the manuals that we're just going through here now are from actually the most recent ones are from where the biggest volume is. And so just to help me sleep better at night, would you confirm that that's actually correct and that the ones that are 20 years old are like for the pocket gophers, which is actually a very, very small part of the commercial market?
Mr. Spitzmuller?
Madam Chair and Representative, thank you. And I think that you could make a strong correlation. I have a slide further in that might illustrate that a little bit, if you'd like me to do that. But generally speaking, we prioritize revision of the manuals. And, of course, part of that priority is with the recognition there's a tremendous amount of resources that go into creating these manuals. So we tend to prioritize where we have the largest population of applicants.
All right.
Madam Chair, however, having said that, too, you notice that we are just going through a multi-year process right now with the turf and ornamental manual, and that is the one that has the largest number of applicants. So it, like many agencies in the hard economic times that we are coming out of now, we have had a lot of early retirements and a lot of cuts, and so we are doing the very best that we can.
All right. How about Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm not looking for an answer. It's to help the department bring information forward. Some of the questions, once again, does the existing fee structure cover the cost as far as the department's concerned? And if not, how has the department covered those costs collectively? Take a look at all the funding sources. Also, what percentage of the manual dollars come in from the federal government as well? Help us understand that. And then back to Representative Anderson's question, why wasn't this a part of the budget, department's budget?
So those are questions that you'll be prepared to answer on Wednesday?
Madam Chair, I will be prepared to answer those, but I can probably answer the last one right now.
Certainly.
The reason why is because the governor's budget is focusing on reducing, you know, on broad issues addressing the structural deficit overall that the state is in. So that's why this did not rise as high as some other issues within our agency, even though it is very, very important. We are on a course to update these manuals, but it could definitely be accelerated. So, you know, the Commissioner of Agriculture wanted me to say that he supports this bill in concept and also supports the funding source. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. And Representative Hansen had a comment, or otherwise we have another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did want to note that I'd introduced this bill last session. Representative Hamilton, when you were chair, I did talk to you about this issue. I think you remember that. That most of the discussion we've had in the committee has been of a fiscal nature. And I would ask if folks have any issues on the policy side of it, which was Section 3, you know, maybe they can approach me between now and on Wednesday. And I know we've run out of time. I do want to thank the university who did send folks over here, and maybe they're available. They will be available again, but I just wanted to note that they were here to talk about some of these questions that were mixing the administration of the licensing program with the manual development and training.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this really is probably more for your discretion to whether or not it's germane, but I also know that the same style of certification licensure is dealt with for herbicide application, and I'm wondering if the same issue applies there as well. So that's a question.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
As far as statute goes, an herbicide is a pesticide. So when we say pesticide, we're including herbicide, we're including rodenticide, we're including insecticide, we're including anything that has a side on it that we're killing is going to be, there's a molluscicide, there's avicides, anything, the broad term is pesticide. So, and this is a very common issue that we're not speaking only of insecticides, we're speaking of the whole broad.
Well, thank you. This is definitely a discussion will continue on Wednesday, and there are some things that perhaps if people have questions specifically, Representative Hansen would be able to try to gather any additional information. He does note that appropriately, this is the Ag Policy Committee. It will be going to Ag Finance, and so more policy issues may be coming forward regarding this, and he can keep in mind the finance issues as it goes forward. But thank you. We will be laying this bill over just until Wednesday and be able to hear and answer some more questions then, and we appreciate the people who were here and weren't able to testify today. But thank you, and we will, we have our student, Brandon, is going to come forward, and I think he actually has a quiz for us eventually, so we got to be on our toes. Okay. And while he's hooking up his computer, I think he's going to get some assistance to do that. We do have some minutes that can be approved. So I'm going to Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the minutes of the last meeting.
Very good. Any additions or corrections? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. The minutes are approved. Thank you. I will ask also, since we're kind of in the middle of that House File 151, if you would just keep the information in your save folders so that you've got it for the future reference and discussion. There's a couple of pieces of information that were included in the presentation, so to do that. For those of you that were able to attend the meet and greet with the FFA students, I was able to meet a number of outstanding young leaders, and so a few of them are going to be coming periodically some Thursdays here in February to do presentations to us. These are FFA students who are actually, this is kind of one of their categories of expertise, that they give presentations. And so it's outstanding that Brandon is with us today, because he is kicking this series off, and his primary presentation focus is on ag literacy, which I think is appropriate so that we can all learn to speak ag a little bit better, hopefully, through his guidance and presentation, and I'm looking forward to it. He also has a Twitter account, and I enjoy reading what he writes and periodically when he's tweeting. He's a clever writer. Yes, Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, ma'am. While we're waiting, do you have that Twitter account handy? Do you know what it is, the handle?
Sure. I'll let him make sure that he can tell us. He does promote agriculture and FFA in a very positive manner. There you go. So he had to travel a distance. I know he had, hopefully the roads weren't too bad. Again, are we doing okay? Or we got, there we go. It's just slow moving. Just taking some time, I apologize. I think it's a slow system. Yes, it is. Dial up in the country. Thank you. I think we've finally connected. Oh, and then it went back. There we go. And when you are ready, if you would just introduce yourself for the record and tell us where you came from this morning, and then we'll have you go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Brandon Ruger. I'm from Sleepy Eye FFA. I'm also a part of Sleepy Eye Public High School. Our FFA chapter also works with the private school across town, St. Mary's Catholic Church, and school, sorry. So all five of us, we're in a prepared public speaking contest, so I'm going to give you my speech with some slides going by, and then at the end I'm going to give you some questions, so you guys hopefully pay attention to the facts that are kind of flashing across and listen at the same time. Just so you know a little bit about the prepared public speaking contest, I explained it all. It's kind of detailed, so there is an invitational at the University of Minnesota in December, and then there's 8 regions in Minnesota. In each region holds its own prepare public speaking contest. My region, Region 6, which is Pipestone up to Marshall to Sleepy Eye down to Jackson, ours was also in December, just a week after the U of M Invitational. The requirements for prepare public speaking is it has to be a 6 to 8 minute speech on an agriculturally related topic, so you couldn't just randomly talk about chairs or some interesting information. It has to be something agriculture related. So in the upcoming weeks you'll hear some agriculture related topics that are from the Prepare Public Speaking Contest. So after you're done coming up with the script for your speech, you send it in to get scored, and then after that's all done you go in for the contest, and then you give your speech, and there's about 2 to 3 judges, and they'll score your delivery, your stage presence, and things like that, just general speech quality. And then after the speech, they'll give you 5 minutes of questions at a maximum, and they'll also score you on that. So that's the whole layout of the Prepared Public Speaking Contest, and you'll see some of my competition in the next upcoming weeks. So I'm just going to get started right away. And I'm sorry if I offend any of you guys. There's some HSUS and PETA things in there, and I don't want to offend anybody if anybody donates to those. Okay? So I'm going to get started. Okay. Have you guys ever seen the Humane Society of the United States commercials? Yeah. These are the commercials where HSUS tells us all about how they're helping poor animals and how you can help them if you send a small donation. Agriculturalists immediately know the underlying fault in this message, and it's the fact that the Humane Society of the United States donates barely 0.5% of its funds to causes actually helping abused animals in animal shelters. For this reason, today I will touch on the topic of agricultural literacy. We'll begin by setting the table of ag literacy while learning about the background of agriculture. Then we'll start serving the food, understanding why agricultural literacy is important to all kinds of people. And finally, we will clean up the mess and talk strategy, discovering the realities of animal agriculture and realizing why the agriculture industry needs strong, innovative young leaders. The Campaign for National Ag Day describes agricultural literacy as the current economic, social, and environmental significance of all Americans. This basic understanding includes some knowledge of food and fiber production, domestic and international processing, and also marketing. Most agriculturalists have heard the story about an urban citizen who submits a letter to the local newspaper telling everybody they should buy their food from a grocery store because that food doesn't come from agriculture. Well, it's important that agriculture's job is to prevent stories like these and educate these type of people on the realities of agriculture. Monsanto's America's Farmers is an example of agriculture education that recognizes the astonishing facts about agriculture today. According to their website, americasfarmers.com, in the 1960s, the average farmer could feed 26 people. Today, the average farmer can feed 155. And one dairy cow can provide enough dairy products for up to 40 people. In the next 50 years, we'll have to produce more food than in the last 10,000 years combined. In order to educate others on these facts, people need to develop ag literacy programs for the 98% of citizens who don't live on a farm. It's been stated that 35% of the Minnesota state economy is related to agriculture. The United States Department of Agriculture has even declared agriculture as the largest employer in the nation, employing 17% of the civilian workforce and providing over 23 million jobs for Americans. The United States Census Bureau has even released a report stating that agriculture has helped build a $34 billion trade surplus in the United States, which is more than any other United States industry. All of these numbers don't make a whole lot of sense if one doesn't look at them in the right way. It's important for agriculturalists to use these numbers to their benefit and to educate others on the significance of these figures. Agricultural literacy long ago coined the phrase, from the farm to the kitchen table, but has at some points lost its key message along the way. Some educators often focus on production agriculture, like farming, and the facts of this sector, but it's also important to include other steps in the process of getting food from the farm to the kitchen table. This includes transportation, marketing, processing, and distribution of the food we eat. It's essential for people to know that the food they eat from McDonald's, from Walmart, a local grocery store, and even a fancy restaurant all come from the same industry. Agriculture needs leaders who are willing to step into our industry, not only in production agriculture and farming, but also in research and management in order to help feed the growing global population. But every day, each aspect of the agriculture industry is threatened by large animal rights activist groups such as HSUS, the Humane Society of the United States, and PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Luckily, our industry has been capable of responding. Most agriculturalists are aware of the false information these organizations have spread. But almost everybody who has not come into connection with agriculture is unaware and uneducated on the facts and the information that is spread by these two organizations. HSUS leads the uneducated public to think that their organization is donating millions of dollars to humane society across the country. But the fact is, HSUS has donated barely 0.5% of its funds to causes actually helping abused animals in animal shelters, according to HumaneWatch.org in November 27, 2012 post. The majority of their money is spent on the media and news trying to shut down practical animal production methods. HSUS practices are very similar to PETA. The only difference is that PETA is upfront about its purpose. As recently as Thanksgiving 2012, according to ProtectTheHarvest.com, PETA released a new advertising campaign to go vegan, even releasing a dog's billboards near California and Nevada with a dog's head on a turkey's body, giving the following message of, "Kids, if you want to eat a dog, why eat a turkey?" HSUS, on the other hand, tries to manipulate the public into thinking their organization is donating millions of dollars and helping millions of animals across the country. This is why agricultural literacy is important. It's important for students to step into the industry to help educate adults, teenagers, and children about the facts of agriculture. According to Humane Watch, 70% of Americans believe HSUS is a pet shelter umbrella group, and it gives most of its money to animal shelters. This fact to agriculturalists is absolutely horrifying, and it's agriculture's duty to set the record straight. However, there are benefits that come out of HSUS that even some agriculturalists don't always realize. Whether you have witnessed it or been a part of it, people are starting to gain that vital agricultural literacy that every citizen of the United States and Minnesota should have, because we now see the need for educating people on the need for agriculture and the need to know where their food comes from. The agriculture industry has begun to come up with some creative ways to spread awareness about the real intentions of HSUS. This is evident in Humane Watch, a website that helps expose the faulty practices of HSUS and give supporting reasons why people should not support their organization. Humane Watch has actually proved HSUS is down in contribution and grants, raking in 10% less revenue in 2011 than in 2010, due mostly to a drop in public support for the organization. Now hold it all in. I know you're all ready to burst out of your seats and go spread agricultural literacy to the rest of the population. But we've got a long way to go. All of these stories, facts, and reasons prove why others need to be educated on the need for agriculture and the need for farmers to feed us. So today, we learned about the importance of agricultural literacy. We learned about the need for strong advocates. And finally, we uncovered some myths about HSUS. The distance from the farm to the kitchen table gets larger and larger, and people don't always realize that the food on their fork comes from production agriculture. These are two essential reasons that everyone needs to be advocating for agriculture. If you want a plain, simple key message to share about agriculture. Just take it straight from Monsanto. America's farmers grow a lot more than just crops. America's farmers grow America. So that was be one of the speeches that I would give in a competition, just so you guys know. Thank you. I'm sorry about those. Is that, does anybody in here donate to HSUS or PETA?
No.
Well, that's good. HSUS and PETA, as I said before, are pretty false organizations. And I gave this speech for competitive speech, too. Actually, no. It was a little bit different last year. I gave a similar speech about HSUS and PETA in competitive speech for the Minnesota State High School League. And I had a judge who thought she was very in support of HSUS and PETA, and she kind of she went crazy on my critique sheet and was a little upset with me.
You know what?
We do have some questions for you, Brandon.
Okay.
So we're going to make sure. And so I'll start the Representative McNamer.
Madam Chair, just one comment. The Humane Societies that are local do an outstanding service.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and myself are highly involved in our Grant County Humane Society. So if you want to give to your local Humane Society, that's money well spent.
All right. Thank you, Representative McNamer. I think Representative Hamilton had a... No, you have a question? Or did you...
You know, you said that one of the judges was upset and critiqued you pretty hard. But the whole point is you're standing up for what you believe in, and you do it in a very, very respectful way. And, you know, that's the whole point on this. Ag literacy and whatnot, it is coming out here and righting what you think is a wrong, correcting what you think is a wrong. And I just want to say hats off to you, because there are many people, many organizations, associations, ag associations that are afraid to do what you just did. And so we can learn a lot from you. Fantastic. Way to go. And typically I harass him. He's a great kid. I've known him. Excuse me, a great young man. And I always call security whenever he's around. Not today. You did well.
Thank you. I would agree. I think, Brandon, you did an outstanding job in putting forth something that would be not necessarily very popular in all circles is a brave thing to do, and showed some courage, and you showed some ability to sift through facts and enlighten us, and we may leave here with a little bit more knowledge and maybe a little bit more of an awareness of some things. So I think that's the purpose. So we appreciate that. But I'm wondering if you're ready to give us the questions, because what I noticed was that the PowerPoint didn't necessarily always follow what you were saying. So you're trying to, you know, you're trying to catch us. We had to do what teenagers do, which is listen and watch a different screen about something differently. So, you know, we'll see if we're up to the task. So you may go ahead and start asking questions.
Okay, I have a couple. Today, the average farmer feeds 155 people. In 1960, the average farmer fed...
Representative Hamilton.
26.
26, okay.
Good job. I have multiple choice, too, in case you guys get stuck.
Oh.
But it's a good job getting without multiple choice. From 1948 to 1994, culture has increased its productivity by this percentage with no increases in its inputs.
Okay, see, we're already lost.
200?
200? Yep, that was right. 200%.
Oh, St. Petersburg, very
no inputs on that, though. 1 inch of water on 1 acre of land equals how many gallons of water? You're going to need options for this. There's 27,152, 50,802, 75,180, or 80,406.
26,075.
Yeah.
Somebody
it's
said
the
first all
one.
Of them.
27,152 inches of water on 1 acre of land. Seems kind of crazy. About 41 types of medicines result from which type of livestock? Pigs, that's right. Which oil is the most widely used edible oil in the United States?
Soybean
oil. Awesome. And the last question. The world will have to produce more food in the next 50 years than it did in the last blank years combined?
10,000.
10,000. Oh. Awesome job.
Very good. So thank you for the opportunity today to come here and share with us that we all learned a little bit more. And Representative Anderson has a comment.
Thanks. Just a quick question. Could you repeat the question about production increasing but no additional inputs? Could you repeat that one again?
From 1948 to 1994, agriculture has increased its productivity by 200% with no increases in inputs. So not necessarily technology, but no inputs in land, because urban populations grow out and then the rural areas get that taken away from them. So I'm guessing that's what it means by the no inputs.
Best management practices and technology, GMOs.
So
you may want to clarify that.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
That it's confusing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I agree.
What I was getting at.
I was thinking energy input or fertilizer or whatever.
Land inputs.
You will have...
I'll clarify that.
So thank you, Brandon, for coming today and for presenting, and we will see some of your competitors in the coming weeks, and so that will be interesting as well, and we appreciate your drive today that you came, and hopefully if you can stay, we're going to try and be able to have you on the floor of session if you're able to stay. We meet at 3 o'clock, so thank you again for that. We do have, now you can sit and listen to one of our members, because Representative Kreisha.
Can I say one more final
yes.
thing, Madam Chair? Okay, so, sorry. My other competitors and I, we were kind of talking about this, the whole presenting here, and we came up with our own little proposal, but not actually a bill, but in FFA, when there's like a whole delegate process where you come up with issues and you solve them, and we kind of wanted to give our own FFA issue and proposal. So each week you're going to hear a whereas statement from each of the competitors at the end of their speech. So mine right here is, whereas agriculture is vital to every Minnesotan's health 3 times each day. And then the last presenter will give it, be it resolved, and then it'll have a simple resolution that relates to all 5 of our presentations combined. We wanted to give something to look forward to in each presentation.
So thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you, Brandon.
Thank you.
And if you could send me the PowerPoint, then I can make sure that everyone on the committee gets that.
Okay.
And also, I think also send your Twitter account so that people can start following you.
Okay.
It would be fun.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And Representative Kreisha now gets to do his commercial about his district, so we get to learn. And just as a reminder, if you did save, if you did save your map, you're going to be able to see we have had... so he's kind of in the almost the direct middle of the state. If
got
you're
it.
Looking at, there
Madam
you go.
Chair. You go to the center and you look up.
Oh, there you go,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, I don't notice a bag of treats anywhere in Representative Kreisha's possession.
So. When you are ready, we're gonna listen attentively as well to your presentation. But you did.
So thank you for the opportunity and.
Yes.
Representative Anderson, I was going to leave this line for the end, but since you brought it up, I won't buy your approval with tasty chocolates and small business satisfaction. I'm actually going to leave you with some knowledge and some things that will improve your life. So.
That's what I was hoping for.
I knew you were looking for more. And so. I'm going to try to be brief. I've got an agriculture summary for our area, Morrison County and Todd County, to give you a little perspective. My area covers between Staples, Minnesota, and down to Royalton, Mille Lacs Lake, over to Long Prairie. So if it gives you a little bit of a perspective, it's between Brainerd and St. Cloud. We have a population in Morrison County of 32,000, ranks 31st in Minnesota. Total employment of 17,000. On-farm employment is 1,900.
Non-farm is 15,000, and I'll bring that up because I want to show you the disparity between Todd County and Morrison County that I cover. Number three in livestock production, number one in broilers, number three beef cows, milk cows, poultry, five in turkeys, and 15 in total agriculture production. One of the things that I'm going to focus on in my presentation is the poultry. It's really growing quite fast in our area. Just briefly, value of ag products sold, $261 million, 16th in the state. Of that $261 million, $233 million comes from poultry livestock, and both of those combined, and second in the state. And give you a little perspective, Camp Ripley, which is also a large provider of economic boost in our area, puts out $333 million. So to give you an idea of the two that happens. Mm. Top crops, you can see there, hay, silage, corn for grain, corn for silage, soybeans. And top livestock, chickens, turkeys, and cattle in that order. Todd County profile, right next door, 24,000 of the population, they rank 42nd. So just by going 20 miles, things change drastically. Total employment, 10,000, 9,000 less. But the interesting thing is if you notice the on-farm employment is within a couple, 10, 12. So it's very, very close there, but the non-farm is where the huge disparity is. And if you've ever been out there, you know the concentration of people, and Long Prairie is the largest city in Todd County. Other than that, you're really on the edge of the woods and the prairie. It's where they meet. Agriculture ranking, they're 23rd in livestock, 5 in beef cows, number 8 in milk cows, and number 10 in poultry. Census data for, and you'll notice the difference, they dropped to 148 million. They go to 42nd, and they, of that 148, 117 million comes from their livestock, poultry, and their products. Their grains, hay, silage, corn for grain, corn about the same. And their top is turkeys, cattle, hogs, and pigs, and then pheasants. And it's interesting because Todd County, and I'll touch on this, Todd County has exploded in the pheasant population, raising them. Many people, how many of you go to South Dakota to hunt? Okay, they're not natural birds. They're not the natural birds that they think. We actually raise a lot of those pheasants from around the country and export them in. I'm a hunting guide in my part-time, and 2 years ago we couldn't get pheasants in the last part of the season because of the weather in South Dakota. They were buying up all the birds at about twice the rate that we were trying to get them in. So a lot of people don't realize that, and they think they're going for this huge population of pheasants. They're being imported in just like everything else. They've become a huge part of agriculture. No. Let's talk turkey. One of the premier turkey producers actually in the state is a gentleman by the name of Kent Meschke. And I was out at his farm. I know the family very well. Amazing turkey producer. When you walk in there, and admittedly, I wasn't as familiar with the turkey industry as when I was a kid, where we fundraised, we went and we grabbed turkeys and we loaded them onto trucks and we made some money, pennies for our fun. When I went out there, Kent took me to, and you're going to hear from him in a second, he took me to his office and he said, "This is where I work." It's the cleanest, most sophisticated office I've ever seen in my life. It was like control center data. He had 5 screens going. He said, "Ron, I watch the markets. I watch the futures. I figure out where the price is. Then I input those in, and that puts out exactly the feed that we want to provide for those turkeys." They know within ounces of how big they want those breasts to be, so that when they resell those back to the producers, they can get their best. It's just absolutely amazing. The same amount of feed that they are putting on in their turkeys today will do a 45-pound turkey. 40 years ago, that would have done a 25-pound turkey. I mean, they're so precise. So we're going to hear from Kent here in just a second because he's a lot more interesting than I am.
My name is Kent Meschke. We have a turkey farm in Little Falls, Minnesota. We've been raising turkeys for over 40 years, and most of my life I've been active on the farm. We're a second-generation turkey farm. We produce light hens. We raise about 700,000 hens a year. Our number one priority is disease prevention, and we take many steps on our farm to prevent disease. We do controlled access to all of our buildings. We don't allow anybody in our buildings that doesn't work for us. We have very strict sanitation on our equipment going from building to building, anything that goes from building to building is washed and disinfected prior to being used in a different building. Yeah, for birds to become infected with avian influenza would be very apparent due to the signs of the bird. You can tell by how the birds act and how they're moving around, if they're feeling healthy, if they're not. We can check our birds, we can do tests to make sure that they aren't coming down with a bird flu or avian influenza. Prior to market, our flocks are tested for avian influenza. We do tracheal swabs, which is a PCR test that will detect if the birds had a current infection. And then we also do blood tests where we take serum samples and send them in. And that will detect if the flock ever had avian influenza in their whole life. So we have a very good monitoring system set up. Flag farms, when we set them up originally, we made sure we had good setbacks from roads so we can avoid traffic of people and any other animals that may be traveling the road. We built our buildings on sites that aren't by wetlands or lakes, and we have a very good containment around our site. Nobody can come through and just drive by and visit the farm for no reason. We're set back off the road to prevent any unnecessary traffic. Our birds are raised in total confinement. That's a thing that's changed over the past. We used to raise birds outside, and they were exposed to wild birds and animals, and we've gone strictly to confined barns. And that way we can prevent any outside predators and wild birds from mingling with our birds, which could cause a major disease issue.
A couple other quick points on that. Thank you, Kent. You did a nice job. When you visit the turkey farms and you see how sophisticated they are, they know the effects of the disease. And they're it's amazing the precautions they take. The other thing that I didn't know in visiting them is the veterinarians for them are very hard and to get. There just aren't many turkey veterinarians. So you saw him doing a lot of the tests with the microscope. They have to be that sophisticated, and from what I understand, in order to apply some of the antibiotics and some of the other medicines, you have to be certified. They have a very hard time getting a veterinarian in to do that. So that was actually one of the challenges they have, because this stuff can happen so fast. Pheasants, I want to talk just quickly about pheasants. A lot of people don't think of them in agriculture, but they're being harvested in the game farm that we're at. Last year we did 25,000 birds in a harvest, and it's amazing. They come through. It's in a hunt, and they're set up, but they're in the natural environment. But those birds are then processed through a sanitized kitchen and handed out to the hunters as they leave. So we can make sure that it's a safe product going out. It's just an amazing experience, and this is growing very rapidly. It's amazing how many pheasants are being, like I said, in Todd County. The numbers at 10,000, that's grown quite a bit because there is such a high demand for these, and especially in South Dakota. The game farms are becoming very popular, and it does bring in an amazing amount of seasonal jobs and tourism. The other thing that I want to talk a little bit about our district is we have a couple of other pieces of agriculture that I don't want to go unnoticed, one of which is the CSAs and the fully organic farms. There's a couple of them that are growing rapidly around the Randall area where farmers have decided that a great way to help out is they have increased these plots and they bring the public in and they all share in part of it and they've made it completely organic. The other thing that we have in our area out in Piers is Smoothie Sunflower Oil. And they've started pressing sunflowers and making those into a wonderful product, sunflower oil, which actually is phenomenal as an alternative to some of the other oils that you use. And they've grown and quite extensively. And it was funny, when I was talking to him, I said, well, how are you keeping up? He said, well, we have this little dishwasher, and they're now in retail stores, and they're washing bottles through a regular kitchen dishwasher. And so they were trying to get a loan just so they could get a couple more dishwashers to keep up with the demand. So sunflower oil is becoming a very prominent in our area. So that's my presentation. What I wanted to leave you with, I know, Representative Anderson, you can't wait for this, but what I'm going to leave you with is two turkey recipes for Valentine's Day that you can share with your significant other, and they're just fantastic. One is heartthrob turkey steaks, and the other one, of course, everything's great with bacon, so this is turkey bacon wrap medallion. Ooh, so that's all the nutritional info. So
great. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Quisha. Representative Nornes.
Madam Chair, I was just going to add, I believe the turkey bacon is made in Pelican Rapids. Some of it, anyway. Yeah.
All right.
That's in my district.
Well,
oh, can I?
Yes,
one thing I forgot. Quisha. When I visited the turkey farm, and so I talked to Ken, I said, you know, so at Thanksgiving, well, there are two things on Thanksgiving. First of all, remember, if it wasn't for the turkey industry, we would shut down on Thanksgiving because we can't pardon the turkey, the football can't be on, and I mean, it just shuts everything down. But the other thing is, I said, so at Thanksgiving, do you just go grab a turkey? He says, no. We get the turkey card like everybody else because it's cheaper just to go to Coburn. So. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you. And the connection I have with Representative Quisha, I grew up on a turkey farm. So I love turkey. But that's all we have today. Thank you. Have a good weekend. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you.